extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental Tire from the AT&T 5G Virtual Studios. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, Kalen Carr, David Goss, Matt Doyle. Welcome to the Audi 2021 MLS Cup Playoffs, New England Revolution, an extra special thank you to Real Salt Lake. Wow! 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 Sunday! Incredible! Wearing my Sporting KC jersey to say adios to the team that, I don't know, just doesn't work out for them in the playoffs. The miracle continues. The fairy tale continues. How you guys feeling today? Like, if you're not high on RSL, what are you high on? That's what I gotta say.
Well, I actually accidentally...
Well, we finished this show last night with Goss literally singing the RSL Believe song.
Yeah, I should have started it that way, right?
I'm surprised we didn't open with
it. I gotta tell you, like, for someone who loves musical theater as much as David does, you would think he would have a better voice. But that's just miserable, man.
Yeah, it's terrible. No, I'm terrible at singing.
I think it's like a man of the people voice. It's the sort of thing you hear in the supporters section, man. Everybody just belting it out. Nobody cares how they sound individually. It's about the collective, all right?
The team is the star.
Pablo Masrini would tell you that. Pablo would tell you that, okay? If you're looking for outside affirmation, Dave, you're a lost soul. So don't look to Doyle for, you know, kind words about your singing voice.
I will stop singing when they
look to Steven Sondheim, though.
RIP to a legend. I will stop singing when they cut out my vocal cords, when they cut out my heart, when they rip off my fingers. That's when I'll stop. I got you, Pablo.
Your fingers have nothing to do with your ability to
sing. Yeah, but neither does playing soccer.
It's how he keeps the beat, you know?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3.
Got you.
I think we could just mute you.
Wow. Oh, man. Big show here on this Monday. Of course, we're talking Real Salt Lake. We're going to talk New England Revolution and NYCFC. That is the next game on the docket, Tuesday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, FS1 and Fox Deportes for that. But by the way, the Revs, 9 of the 14 teams in the playoffs are gone. There's only three left alive, and here the Revs are after 3 weeks, finally playing a game. We'll see if that matters to them. But, look, the opening bit here has to, again, be RSL. I mean, we had MLS for RSL with CCL. It sort of feels like neutrals for RSL is the way things are going. And also Seattle Sounders fans now. Like, they're coming out of the woodwork. It helps when you beat Sporting Kansas City. But
Timbers fans were cheering for them yesterday so they could host the home game. Literally everyone in MLS outside of KC and maybe Rapids fans were rooting for RSL in that game.
Is this the best underdog story in MLS Cup playoffs history or just MLS history overall? Like, can you think of a better one? And when you think of it, I was going through my memory banks here. Like, you have to actually go back to, like, 09 RSL. Mm-hmm. This RSL team actually had a 500 record. That RSL team had a losing record and went to win MLS Cup, took it a step
and
further.
Both teams won the Desert Diamond Tucson Cup. So
Desert Diamond Cup, yes. That's a very important start to your life as an underdog. I mean, you have DC in 2004.
My big one is Red Bull in 08 going to MLS Cup out of the Western Conference as the final seed, just because it's comedic that the New York Red Bulls were the Western Conference champions that year. And they were the lowest seed. They beat the MLS Cup holders at the time in the Houston Dynamo. And then they went on to the cup. But they didn't win. So, I don't know. Maybe RSL wins this. And then it would be all.
And I just want to say, for Sounders fans, I know why they feel a kindred spirit here. Because, I'm just going to say, in 2016, exact same regular season record, exact same conference finish. That Sounders team, same performance in MLS Cup when it comes to shots on goal, got the job done. So you see why there's sort of an emotional connection made there.
I think the emotional connection has more to do with RSL playing Portland next. I would wager that most of Seattle's support for RSL at this point comes because of the team that will be on the other bench.
They might drive down to the match.
Right? Get in there.
Put on some claret. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think partly also you have to think about just the off the field things that have been around this team. Yeah. And that's got to play into the narrative, too, of, like, you know, not having an owner, having your manager leave mid-season. Like, we've seen people leave teams or you know, get transferred out of the league.
By the way, but not in, like in this, 2016, right? Siggy was let go, and Brian Schmetzer, the assistant, rose to lead that Sounders
yeah.
team. So again, parallels.
But with the circumstances around this, definitely have to
yeah,
add
but they also
to,
brought in Nico Lodero in the middle of that season.
Yeah, that's true.
And RSL brought in Jonathan Menendez. Helps. I think those are different scales of size.
Yeah, look, it is. It's no owner. It's a head coach that leaves to go to essentially a conference rival. Literally nobody believed in him. Like, none of us believed in him. I'm not sure their own fans did at the start of the season. And what Pablo had to say after this one is like, hey, you tell a bunch of professional athletes that they don't have it, and they're going to try to prove you wrong. Now, fact of the matter is, most of the time, teams like that don't make the postseason. Not because of the critics or the pundits or whatever it is, because of the talent deficit and of the uncertainty and just like the rigmarole that is this season for RSL. And yet, here they are on the backs of hope and belief and late season or late game heroics.
So what?
I mean, Anderson Julio off the bench.
So what you're saying is that, like, Galaxy are the fair godmother of this whole story. They made this happen. They made sure this team got
by not being able to defend.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man. On today's show, of course, more RSL, more Pablo. Talking Sporting Kansas City and what went wrong for them yet again in the playoffs. The Union are on to their first ever conference final, by the way. Got it done in penalty kicks against Nashville SC, who draw and leave these playoffs in a fitting fashion. And the Revs, as we said, are finally going to play a game. We are going to give that conference semifinal Revs NYCFC a really close accounting here. That should be a really, really good game. Be sure to check out, of course, Steve Zakwani and Charlie Bohm over at MLSsoccer.com. They got three things apiece from Sunday's matches. Tom Bogert's on top of all the offseason decisions around MLS. Some interesting ones from DC United this morning. They just came out. They let their number 5 overall draft pick in the Super Draft go. Adios, along with a number of other players. Some negotiations happening. But Tom is all over every single one of those sort of roster newsers where you start to see how things shape up for 2022. Some other news, if you want some gear, 20% off at Cyber Monday MLS store. So if you're listening Monday night, head over there, get your 20% off. And congratulations to Orange County. USL champions got it done in St. Pete against the Rowdies.
You know, so it was like really Sunday. Congratulations to Rich Hernandez, who had a tough one with Club America getting eliminated in the Liga, but he still got Orange County. That's his roots. That's the team of his heart.
That is his roots.
Our guy
and
Rich.
If you don't know Rich, he is the producer of Instant Replay, so I'm sure he's someone very close to your heart.
So
you've never been frustrated with him whatsoever.
If you ever have a problem with what's said on Instant Replay, Rich is the guy you should abuse on Twitter, 100%.
Don't talk to me. Exactly. I say it, but he decides what gets into the final product, so he is like, you know, he is the fairy godmother, you might say, of Instant Replay. All right, let's dig in a little deeper to the Sporting Kansas City RSL match. Look, Trey Fitzgerald's out here tweeting this. He's been preaching the gospel for a while now on this matchup, and there's been heat to this one for a long time. Was it Desert Diamond Cup that Roger and Javi Moe got into it? I think it probably was, to be honest with you. So there's a lot going back to Arizona and Tucson. But since 2013, that win for Sporting Kansas City in MLS Cup, RSL are 5-1-3 at KC. They're 9-2-5 in MLS play. That's excluding the Orlando bubble. That's frankly incredible given how good Sporting Kansas City has been over that period, and they do it yet again. A PK for Sporting early on, but this was not the same RSL game plan, performance, end result in Kansas City as it was in Seattle, Doyle. They approached this in a different way. Honestly, that was the thing I was most impressed by. After sort of bunkering for their lives and defending as if everything depended on it, which it did, they opened it up a little bit. They won the possession game. They won the XG game. Like, they were the better team, I think, in Kansas City, which is, I mean, honestly, astounding.
Yeah, it is. And let me actually toss it to Gas, because 4 fire trucks just showed up outside my house. Nice. So I think this is about to get loud here. I'm going to mute for a minute.
Yeah, it's one of the things that all the conversation last week was, they didn't get a shot on goal. They didn't really come out to play against Seattle. It's a miracle they got through. They only got through for penalty kicks. And I think in our pregame conversation, we sort of said the same of, like, not that we didn't really see a way for RSL to win, but we knew how it would look because they struggle in transition. KC liked to dominate the ball. So RSL will sit in a deep block. And that was never the case in this game. They came out with conviction. They pushed higher and KC allowed them to. And it was a negative to KC because they were never able to battle in this game. They were always second best, whether it was in duels, whether it was second balls. It was energy, whatever. KC was always on their back foot in this game. RSL took the initiative. They created chances. Rubio Rubin should have had an opportunity on goal or a penalty kick. Either one should have happened. Neither did, which is a frustrating moment. And then you give up the penalty. And I felt like Johnny Russell started to leave KC back into the game after the penalty. And RSL responded again. And that's what's incredible, right? You look at how many games that we see in the sport where the team that played better and maybe surprisingly goes down 1-0 on the road. And then you fall, you collapse. Okay, we gave our best. This sucks. It was a brain fart from Aaron Herrera. It was a bad moment. And then they somehow fight back and they find their feet again. They're able to be the better team. And then they bring in the bench mob. And this bench mob is probably right now one of the best units in the world or in the league. And
I love how you almost
in the world.
In the world.
I like all of a sudden I got excited, man. Yeah. We're here for RSL.
There is no other world. This is world, yeah.
But look at the way Ruiz played in central midfield against all of this experience that he's going up against. Look at the way that Demir Krylov was able to
Ruiz. That's the thing. Sporting Kansas City never got close to it. And good news, my building is not on fire, so I was able to unmute here.
I was waiting for you just to like run out of the screen.
Yeah, yeah. But like the way that RSL were able to control this game, it was part of it was just Sporting Kansas City not being up for it. And Johnny Russell said as much after the game. He said, "We played this game not to lose. We didn't play to win," which is a brutal thing to say, especially for a veteran team playing at home. But part of it was like, just look at central midfield. Anytime Ruiz got on the ball, he had the opportunity to switch to one wing or the other. And for the first 65 minutes, that was Menendez on one side and Chang on the other, and they didn't really have it. They just didn't. But then they brought in Anderson Julio and Justin Miram, and they replaced Rubin with Wood. And it was the same game plan for RSL. Pablo didn't have to change anything tactically. He just put in fresh legs, better players on the day, and they cracked Sporting Kansas City open very, very easily. And it was the whole process was weird because Sporting played a low line, just like they did against Vancouver. And when you do that, the idea is, one, we're not going to give up anything in behind us. And two, we're going to get pressure in through central midfield. And now the sirens are back. So I'm going to mute again. So there you go.
I actually like the sirens. I feel like it's good background noise. You know, for years, we've tolerated a literal radiator randomly clanking at high volumes, and now we're saying that sirens are too much for us.
It's just getting gnarly here because there's like five or six in a row have gone right down by block.
But
so
Doyle,
I'm afraid it's going to blow everything out.
But Doyle, to your point, and what I was saying in terms of the way KC chose to play this game, to drop that high line, it worked against Vancouver last week, but it made them passive in this game. And the way Russell said it after, it made them individually passive, and they didn't battle. They didn't win the ball. They didn't win second balls. And I felt like Johnny Russell was the only one out there who was really trying to test players to try and push things. And
I think Kinda was.
Fair. Kinda's not that type of player. He's active. Right. He's around, but he doesn't really create out of nothing. And he isn't a physically dominant player. But yeah, that's fair. But they started Pulido as well, who hasn't played in 2.5 months.
And
you could see the quality that he has. But he wasn't pulling players around like he can at his peak. He wasn't hitting clean balls. He had one opportunity where he was sort of clipped in over the top, and it's a long touch, and Ochoa comes out and wins it. So credit to that. The other thing with RSL we have to say is we've talked a lot about David Ochoa and how good he's been, but you can only bring the bench group in if Glad and Silva and Luis play as well as they do. And the worst times of the year for RSL – they've exposed that back line, but they've also just been individually messy. And you've seen RSL games, and we'll talk about it with Portland, right? Because they outplayed Portland the second to last game of the season, and they got annihilated at home. And it was all individual errors along the back line. Defenders turning their hips the wrong way, no communication in key moments. And that hasn't been the case. Silva and Glad have been dominant. Luis has given them the support that they need. Brody has swapped from the right back to left back spot and has been as good as he was at right back. And Herrera's has played right center back and right back now at a high level outside of that one mistake. And credit to him. He was dominant in the right in the second half, like attacking from that right spot rather than dropping his head and being like, I'm an idiot. I don't know what I was doing on the road at KC. I give up a terrible penalty, and he fought his way back into it.
Gladys stood out for me as you know, one of the best defenders of this tournament. And, you know, you go through the first match in Seattle, and, you know, we've been talking a lot about Ochoa, but he really hasn't been asked to make a ton of saves or to stand on his head. And I think a lot of that has happened because you just see the ball. Glad seems to just always be in the right place to be able to intercept passes and kind of like have key interventions in the box. Obviously, he scores the game-winning penalty on the road up in Seattle as well. I think he's been tremendous. On the other side for Sporting Kansas City, I was disappointed. You guys were talking about it, this line of confrontation, because there were a few times where they were actually able to pick off possession when they did press a little bit higher and create opportunities from that. They just weren't able to do it. And then with Herrera getting a yellow card 22 minutes in, he's aggressive, right? And he didn't really change his style of play. But also, Sporting Kansas City didn't target him. They did not get either Shallowy, who was mostly a non-factor, and then they didn't really switch Russell even to the other side. It just felt like an opportunity to really try and go at that side. Kinda slid over there a couple times more. Obviously, that was the case when he drew that penalty. But it just looked like an opportunity to maybe shift something or push something towards that side to see if you can really expose that weakness. I mean, Herrera almost got a second yellow in the second half, like it before extra time, which I actually thought was a yellow card that should have been called, and was just not, you know, he was very aggressive throughout the whole match. But those are the little margins where you're saying, if you can get him off, that's going to change you going into, well, they didn't make it to extra time, but towards the end of the match and leading towards it. But ultimately, yeah, I think, you know, it was the substitutions that made the big difference I think Peter played his hand a little bit by starting Pulido to say, we're at home, we're going to go with our, you know, top striker from the jump, as opposed to wearing him down with Kyrie. To me, that's more of a situation where if you're going to play on the front foot, but if you're going to sit back a little bit and not go with the same sort of approach, then you go with Kyrie in that situation, because that's what you did in the last game. So the problem was at a certain point when they wanted to switch it up and they wanted to attack more or press, that's when they didn't really have the guns to do it, because Kyrie is a little bit more of a hold up player and a guy that's going to kind of bang and be an outlet than necessarily Pulido, who, when you have the ball, a lot of the ball or a lot of the chances in and around it, somebody who can create and facilitate and drop off and do some of that. So I think they kind of played their hand early to go with Pulido, and then once you see things go in the other direction, I just think Sporting Kansas City didn't have the depth that Real Salt Lake had. And Real Salt Lake, you know, and also Peter doesn't really use a lot of substitutions. You look through the last like five or six matches, there's games where there's one substitution or two. I think there was two substitutions in this one. Espinoza was the other. RSL just had a deeper bench. And as the match went on, you would have thought that would have favored Sporting from being at home and not playing extra time and not traveling. But it completely shifted in the other direction from like 30 minutes left
it
in the match.
I mean, deeper bench, but also two guys that are just like, that they've basically, I don't know, developed into these roles in Miram and Anderson Julio, right? Like, they have, over the course of this season, and certainly the second half of the season, in particular with Miram, like, they've created super subs.
They have.
These guys have become true game-changing, game-winning, result-saving players off the bench. Like, it's no surprise that those two, along with Bobby Wood, yet another guy who's sort of played that role, come in and change the game in this way. Now, Anderson Julio, I just watched this. We talked about it, and you guys were like, oh, your defender of the year, Fontas, giving up on that. You watch that first goal over and over. The run that he makes and that he always makes when he comes on are so difficult to deal with. Like, he's got, I think, the left back tracking him as he's coming across the box. He continues that run. Ilya looks at him. He's like, I don't know what to do. Fontas has got Demir Krylak pulling him to the back post. And all of a sudden, he's wide open, and Brody flips a ball into the front, into the near post, and he rises and dunks it, and Tim Ilya's in no man's land. Justin Miram turned Graham Zusi into a statue.
I think time turned Graham Zusi into a statue. Justin Miram just
well, Justin Miram is, you know, he's a victim of time too, fair. So to speak. He's getting older, but he wasn't showing in that moment. But he's fresh and like he knows his role. Even in that Seattle game, Justin Miram came on, and you could tell that the role was just like, hey, Justin, you got to make some magic. He was trying things that nobody else was trying, and he can do things that nobody else can do. He may not do them with the consistency that he used to, but like we've seen that play a million times. Right? Justin Miram facing you up, using his right foot to push it past you, the little pause, and then he's on his left, and he's got options, and Bobby Wood makes the right run. Like, bing, there it is.
Here's the thing, though, and I agree with you, but what stands out to me is not just what they get from the subs, but that Anderson Julio and Justin Miram are supposed to be starters on this team, and they've developed Andrew Brody and Pablo Ruiz, and they brought Rubio Rubin in from San Diego. That allows those players to come off the bench. And before this season, I think Peter Vermes said some quote about they signed 13 homegrowns, are the only team in the league that could play a full homegrown 11, whatever it is. Where are they? And that's what's frustrating about Sporting KC is they have been phenomenal in the regular season over the last 8 years. But let's talk about the last 3 years. But they try harder probably than anyone else in the regular season to win those games. And there is no foresight into how do we build to the playoffs. And I don't want to say, like, obviously Peter Vermes knows what he's doing, right? He's built one of the great teams in MLS history. He's won MLS Cup. And to his point, KC's a small market. They continue to be a contender every year. What they're doing works. But if you want to win MLS Cup, you need to be able to have more than two subs on your bench who are useful to you. And your starters need to be fit and healthy and ready to go. And that balance isn't there. I said to you guys in the meeting before, I talked to someone in the Western Conference front office in preseason putting together my rankings, and they were like, always pick KC first because they're always going to try and win the regular season, but they don't win MLS Cup after that because they exhaust themselves. And I laughed at it because they're one game knockouts, anything can happen, but this is now three straight years where KC, or three straight runs where KC has lost a playoff game at home, which means they have earned the home seed and they cannot win in the postseason. And at this point now, it's a trend.
Yeah, it's who they are as a team. And Peter Vermes is one of the great coaches in MLS history. He has proved that time and time again. But he has this blind spot for substitutions and for creating depth. And in this particular... Well, I think it's telling that it is inconceivable to imagine talking about Sporting KC winning a game in the way that RSL won this game. It's inconceivable to me to imagine we're sitting here 12 months from now being like, man, that game completely changed in the second half when Vermes brought in those attacking subs and changed the team shape a little bit and drew a different line of confrontation and started playing on the front. Like, Sporting Kansas City doesn't do that. They're a really well-prepared team every single year. They have very good players throughout the field, but this time of year, they're always playing worse than they were in July, August, and certainly at the start of the year because they're worn out, and they never have game changers to bring in off the bench. And it doesn't have to do with being a small market team. It does not have to do with being a small market team. RSL is a smaller market team than Sporting Kansas City is. And we
Michael
saw what
Chang
they did
started this
one.
Game from Charleston, and they brought him into Real Monarchs. There's not a single player on this team that started with SKC2, right?
Yeah.
You have the tools that they have. You just haven't used them.
It is a weird blind spot for one of the great coaches and great GMs in MLS history. I will say that there have been, over the past 12 hours, there have been Sporting Kansas City fans in my mentions saying that Vermes has to go.
No.
Those people
chance.
Are insane.
Yeah.
If he gets you 60 points every single year and you play good soccer.
We're talking about a tweak. Peter Vermes is 98% of the way there every single year. We're talking about the 2% that gets you over the line in a one-off knockoff competition. We are not talking about in any way a massive change to the way Sporting KC operate themselves.
Yeah.
I want to throw just a tiny note on the SKC 2 and the depth. Like, it's not the attacking side, but they did sell, who played at Sporting KC 2, Gianluca Busio, for many millions in the middle of the season. He was a starter for them and a very important player. And if you're talking about sort of fight, and like we had a tweet here that says, why does Sporting not have the brawler killer instinct, and what changes do you make to get one? Yeah, like there's a lot of context around the Felipe Hernandez absence right now, and if you go search, you can understand that a little bit better. He is a guy who came up through that system as well and has that sort of brawler instinct. I'm not saying that Felipe Hernandez would change the game. I'm just saying that it's not bereft from Peter. But you guys are absolutely right in the sense that from an attacking perspective, there was not a player on that
Even if there was a player, I don't believe that Vermees would use them. I just don't. He never has. It is his blind spot as a coach, and it's what, frankly, prevents him from being, like, maybe the greatest coach in MLS history. To me, like, that, it is just such a clear blind spot, and it has cost this team, now, as David said, three straight playoff runs. They finished with a loss at home. That's only been done twice before in MLS history, and one of those times is Chicago Fire over the past decade. Kalen was on one of those Chicago Fire teams. That's how far back you have to go with that.
No. I beat one of those Chicago Fire teams.
No, wow. It started in 2009. Weren't you on the Fire in 2009?
Yeah, I was. I was injured.
Yeah, it doesn't count.
They didn't have enough depth because Kalen was there.
Exactly.
The big knock to me on Sporting in the past, at least from what I remember, was more that they have good players, they have good team, they have energy, they're up for it, you know. And partly to lose those home games, you have to get those home games. So I guess that's just a small note of just getting home field to lose them in the playoffs. But was more that they wouldn't go out and get that big time number nine, and that they needed a big star to get them over the hump in the playoffs in the most important piece of the season. And they went out and did that with Pulido, and he just hasn't been healthy or consistently healthy enough to get a good run of games. And even when I look at the way Seattle went out, was also similarly where Rui Diaz was not ready. Jordan Morris, you know, you talk about these clearly defined roles. Jordan Morris goes, you know, over 100 minutes or whatever it was in that match, as opposed to finding his role coming off the bench because they needed him a little bit early. In this one, it's the same thing with Pulido, where they go from him from the start, and Kyrie Shelton has been starting, as maybe not now, you know, set up for being that game-changing sub off the bench. Or And then, you know, just looking at that front three for me, like Shallowy, Pulido, and Russell were, you could say, all of them were great this season. But how often were they great at the same time? Like, there was almost no time where it was Shallowy at the beginning of the year where he was just carrying this team on his back, right? And game-winning goal after game-winning goal and just flying. And then at the end of the season, it was Johnny Russell. And, you know, he steps up and gets the penalty in this one as well, but it just never really, even on the last day in the last match, it just never seemed quite connected between the group of them to understand, okay, well, you know, this pass is just a little bit behind, or this one's in front, or I'm not quite expecting, or knowing. It was kind of individual hoping that Johnny Russell mostly was going to create something. So I think, you know, that was a part of it, and injuries, availability, those things really kind of hurt. And I looked down the bench and there wasn't really a lot of options from what I saw. And yeah, I don't know what goes into that, or, you know, why that is for this team. But I think the injuries, especially for Sporting, and not having a healthy Pulido to kind of really have throughout the run, I think it really hurt them.
That was speed hurts them. We know that. We knew that all year long. And it was easy to, and I was all aboard on the Graham Zusi like performance of a lifetime in the playoffs against the Whitecaps. But you know, he, Fontas, Ilie, like, there's a reason why there was space.
Anders, can you throw up Fontas' passing map in this, though, for Defensive Player of the Year?
Oh, my God. I'm not the only one in here that voted Fontas for Defender of the Year. I just want to throw that out.
Because Weeby's 18 levels deep. He's such a genius. He knows that Fontas is the best defender.
I'm not going to drag Doyle's name into this, but I believe we both made that.
Yeah, I had him for Defender of the Year. He was really good in the regular season, but he's another one who wore down. He was nowhere near as good in October and now November as he was throughout most of the season.
He played basically every minute of the year.
Yeah,
you know whose team didn't lose to RSL in the playoffs and didn't concede a goal? Yaimar. Because they went to penalties at 0-0 and lost in penalties.
That's some Nashville SC logic right there, all right? Yeah, hold off on that.
Boy.
We've talked a lot about Sporting Kansas City. Do you have any final thoughts there? Because we got to go back and look ahead to
I don't have final thoughts on Sporting Kansas City. I want to hear Kalen talk about that Anderson Julio run. Because that was absolutely just a genius goal-scoring run off of a big target forward in the box. It reminded me of Kalen Carr and Brian Ching back. I'm just saying.
We don't see that often. It's just you don't see that kind of, you know, interplay around. You know, the sort of interesting part to me is you have to have some understanding or a relationship for that to happen, where you know that Krylak is going to move to and vacate the spot for you to come into, and the timing of the run and the service was perfect. And it was a great ball into the box as well, and it just draws Melia off enough to say, maybe I can get this one. And Anderson Julio just kind of glides in and knocks it down. But that was a fantastic run, as was the Bobby Wood one to create some room as well from Justin Miram. And Justin Miram, yeah, we kind of went after Graham Susi in this one. But if you give a guy like Justin Miram 20 yards head start, and then you're going to go into a back pedal. It's like any kind of wide receiver cornerback situation where it's going to be pretty hard to move your hips like that and turn. And Justin Miram is one of the best as far as he can cut inside with that little right foot and curl it, or he can kind of drag it just like he did and accelerate and find that pass. And it was an amazing finish by Bobby Wood. And so, you know, for me, we were talking so much before about cutting hearts out and legs and all that and running. That's kind of what it was in Seattle, where they survived. But this was really more about their quality from Salt Lake, where they really showed their quality, especially in the two goals. But even through the run of play with the ball, you know, I think everybody on Sporting Kansas City, including Vermees, deferred to say they were the better team. And, you know, it was clear.
I know we have Thursday's show. We will talk about RSL Portland in that one. But what's fascinating is RSL could play either way at Portland, because Portland struggles to break down a low block. But at the same time, they'll probably give you the ball if you come and take it and you want to push your fullbacks or wingbacks, whatever it'll be for that game, high if you're RSL. So it's interesting. And I would say, based on what we've seen in 2 weeks, 3 weeks if you add decision day, there's no reason to think that RSL can't go a win, especially if there's no Sebastian Blanco, especially if there's no Dairon Asprilla. Like, what killed RSL versus Portland, as I talked about, was those special players having special moments against the run of play. If Portland doesn't have those guys, now you're looking at an RSL team that sort of dominated Portland for two games and lost like 12-1 on aggregate over the course of those games.
Before we get into that one, can we just, I mean, the vibes for RSL right now, like, this is a, you know, it's not a dream to like finish seventh and sneak in and have a bike to Demir and a missed penalty call, et cetera, to get into the playoffs. But like, this is intoxicating, this run. For neutrals, certainly, ultimately for RSL fans. Like, I was watching video of RSL, you know, celebrating on the field for one, but then celebrating in the locker room and then getting their flight back and getting to the airport, and like Anderson Julio's jumping out of the bus as there are flags waving around him and people are singing the I Believe, like, chant. Like, what a moment for a fan base that, as we sort of said, with all the uncertainty and all the just like, I mean, it's not just this year and the acrimony of this year. It's Petke and everything that happened there. It's everything with Deloy and everything that happened there. It's just sort of this, like, multiple years of rugs just being pulled out, and this being, I don't know if you would call it a reward, but just like an explosion of emotion and of accomplishment that's, I don't know. Again, we go back to it. I don't know if there's a better fairy tale story in MLS history, given all the things that sort of are in the cauldron being stirred together and what's come from it. Like, is Pablo Mastroianni the coach of this team? Like, can you walk away from Pablo given everything that's happened with them? I mean, they don't have an owner, so they don't have a clear, you know, if I was a coach out there, I'd be like, ooh, I don't know.
Their coach,
like,
literally left for an assistant job because of the situation, like, they had.
It'd be hard to accept a job that another guy had and left. Like, this feels like it's going to be Pablo's team, at least for the foreseeable future. Kind of like Vanni Sartini, it's hard to say adios to him, but I don't know how long you keep him at the same time if a new ownership group is coming in and they'll want to make their own decisions across the technical side whenever that does happen.
Well, he's certainly got the locker room behind him at this point, you know, and like that's the most important thing. And I think he's just I think they've kind of tuned out the rest. You know, they're not really thinking about anything else. And I think Pablo in general is like he's focused on that team. And even in the, you know, in the post-game conversations or whatever, he's constantly deferring to the players and the kind of the spirit of the team. Which is always a good, you know, that's the type of manager you want to play for. Like, yeah, I've played for managers like that, that you're like, oh man, he continues to celebrate our, like what we're doing as players and not taking the credit as, especially in a position where he might be inclined to, cause he's, you know, trying to fight for his own job or fight for his own respect. Cause he's had to kind of, he was on the Houston Dynamo staff last year. He's like kind of had to bounce around and sing for his supper. And, you know, after being a head coach, which is not easy to do. And then now he's finding this kind of moment in the sun, which is incredible. And, but they're fun. Like I would say it shifted for me at a certain point. Cause let's be honest, like that game against Seattle was brutal to watch. Like that was not fun for like a neutral's perspective or like an analyst's perspective.
An absurd way at the end of it when it was over.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It like something began to shift for me where, you know, you see those moments in the locker room, especially where they almost kind of laughed at themselves where he's like giving that speech being like, and we did it with no shots. And everybody's like, ah.
They're flexing, yeah. They're like, ah.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, is that good? Is that not good? Okay. But then they come out in the next match and they show a whole other side, right? Where it does show their quality. And it's not just going to be, we're going to sit and watch Real Salt Lake sit back and suffer and try and hang on all the way or ruin the playoffs or they're surely playing spoiler, but there's something really fun about the way they're playing. And like anytime you see a team that kind of has been discounted and recognizes it, and embraces that, and Ochoa is a big part of that. I think that kind of spirit of the team. But I think something shifted for me where you're saying, okay, well, this is like the team to root for. If you're a neutral, like you're saying, and you don't know who you want to go for, and you're just kind of enjoying these playoffs, you're definitely going for Real Salt Lake. That is the funnest team right now.
David Ochoa, sign off from Instagram Live after this game, which I'm sure was everything about that, I'm sure was a joy for every RSL fan out there. Quote, MLS needs to call Pepe and tell him they need the award back. He's talking about the young player of the year. Yeah, he is stealing that spotlight any way he can, and I appreciate that. Here's the game for you. Saturday, December 4th, 6:30 p.m. Eastern, FS1 Fox Deportes. Timbers hosting RSL. Ochoa against Timbers Army. Pablo against Gio. No, star power, TBD, Sebastian Blanco. I have to imagine the way he pulled up with that hammy. I cannot believe that he would be available to play in this match.
The good news is Ochoa is now doesn't have to worry about yellow cards. I feel like he had to go a little. He had to go calm against Sporting because he was on a suspension. If he got one, I believe you can get a yellow and still play an MLS Cup at this point. So that's also good news.
So look for that prop bet. First half yellow, David Ochoa. I'm just throwing it out.
Which I love that word, like being like, oh, we got to worry about goalkeepers, yellow card suspensions. Like that's
we're supposed to work in. Maybe we're supposed to work in 2022 player of the weekend presented by Body Armor.
Would Ochoa be that guy? Ochoa,
I mean, that's got it. Yeah, he's got to be the guy.
I think. I feel like he would claim it, right? Like,
I'm sorry. Did Jack McGlynn not just ice a penalty kick?
Look at that segue.
Are you talking about Middle Village, New York, baby? Queens.
Wow. Just before we hit the segue in Nashville Union, sounds like Albert Rusnak is going to be back for this game against the Timbers. Will likely return to full training midweek, according to a club spokesperson per Sam Stachkol. So it sounds like he'll be back. We don't know about Dairon. I can't imagine that red card appeal would be successful. That's just outside looking in. I'm wrong about these things all the time. And again, Sebastian Blanco, you figure he's not there. All right, let's talk about it, man. PKs. Dude, I mean, I could start with Jack McGlynn on this, honestly, because that was just that like 25-second period that was amazing. Like his penalty, his reaction, the moment that he was in, the fact that he's a homegrown in this Union team that sold two homegrowns to make room for more homegrowns after winning the Shield and now are here and are hosting potentially if NYCFC beat the Revs in Foxborough on Tuesday. A conference final, but regardless, are in their first conference final. Yeah, that's the big takeaway here. Like, it's just
didn't Jim say he asked for it?
Who, Jack? Yeah, how could he not? Yeah. The way he did that? Yeah. You better believe he was begging for it. Like that. But I saw somebody, I think Heath Pierce tweeted, like, they don't know fear yet, these young players. Like, they haven't been, they're not, like, they haven't been in enough situations to be nervous about that. It's just nothing but, like, pluck and, you know, brass balls, as I think the headline or Jim Curtin's quote was. We'll talk about that in a second. But, well, overall, this game, Doyle, Philly and Nashville, we knew it was going to be super tight. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of the way both these teams have been. They were same points in the regular season. We know Nashville is the team of draws / destiny. what did you make of this game overall?
It was a scrap. There weren't a lot of pretty moments in this game. That said, Nashville's goal was gorgeous. That was a 16-pass buildup, back to front, touchline to touchline, attacking Philly in the exact right way to attack. Because Philly plays that 4-3-2-1 Christmas tree, or they did at the start. They eventually switched to the diamond. Either of those formations, you want to take advantage of your wing backs and the space that they will just naturally have, because any type of 3-5-2 or 3-4-2-1 will just play wider than the Christmas tree or the diamond. So they were able to go from one touchline to the other and then back again and get Eric Miller in an acre of space, time to pick his head, take a touch, pick his head up, and then pick out his cross. And what a cross it was. That was the 16th pass in the sequence, and a diving header, picturesque goal from Hani Mukhtar. I mean, that's how you draw it up. What you don't draw up is 4 minutes later, you give up the equalizer on a set piece, which is the second game in a row that Nashville conceded an equalizer on a set piece. They haven't been good defensively on set pieces all year, and there's no real explanation for that I could see. And then the rest of the game, I thought, tilted towards the Union, especially so once they brought Sergio Santos on. It was the second game in a row that he has been kind of a difference maker in terms of the balance of the game. And the issue with the Union, the issue with Sergio Santos, is like, he's a difference maker in that way, but he's not a difference maker in putting the ball in the back of the net. And this is what I said after the game last night, is like, for the second week in a row, it was less about winning for the Union than it was about being like a team that was tough to beat. Be it like not losing. And last week they got the miracle from Jakub Gleznis with that wonder goal.
I mean, can you call it a miracle if it's replicable?
That's
and
fair.
Has happened before? I think that's a, I don't,
I think, well, I mean, he usually just smashes them, actually, right? He doesn't bend them in like that one.
Which we should talk to Jamiro Montero about.
Yeah.
Just show him
my
tape.
God. If Jamiro Montero ever takes another free kick in a good spot, I will lose my mind.
Where's the analytics community on that one? Hey, Jamiro, like, I'm just going to show you the numbers, man. Like, this one probably not for you.
From what I understand of Jamiro's personality, that would not dentist confidence in his ability to take those shots. And then this one, like, once it got to penalty, I thought Nashville was playing with house money. I thought they were going to come out and be ruthless, and it was the complete other way around. And this was the moment where Andre Blake reminded everyone that the Union are not a team that lacks stars. They do have a star. It's their goalkeeper. He's one of the two best in the league. He's one of the two or three best in CONCACAF. And once he saved that Mukhtar penalty, it felt like it was all over, and it turns out that was the case.
By the way, 15 to 35 goals this year allowed by Nashville were from a dead ball or set piece. That's 43%.
That's brutal.
It's a pretty incredible number, especially given the fact that they have Walker Zimmerman back there. Walker said afterwards, we got to figure this thing out. You were talking about the run and the two-man sort of like interplay, Kalen. I thought the same thing was very, very apparent on Nashville's goal, where Hani is really mostly a second forward, and he comes into that space created by CJ, and a beautiful header. What a season for him. But come on, man, four missed penalties. And I had somebody in my DMs. I'm going to go check this out. I think it's something like, let's see, here's the stat. Nashville has actually missed 8 consecutive shootout penalties.
Oh, wow.
8 in a row in shootouts. They missed the last one against Cincy in 2018, then went 0-3 in 2019 U.S. Open Cup, and now 0-4 in this one. So 8 straight shootout penalties they've missed. I don't know what the odds on that would be, but it would have to be crazy.
I mean, penalties are converted at like a 75% rate, I want to say, in the shootout.
I mean, yeah, you're talking probably hundreds of thousands to millions, probably millions.
Eight straight misses. That. Like, yeah, that might
also,
be
it's
in
across,
the seven
like,
figures.
Technically, like two franchises, like such a different range of players, which is even harder to do. It's not like, yeah, this group is really bad at penalties. You know they're going to miss. It's like the players are completely opposite on both of them. So that's fairly impressive. Congratulations to Nashville.
Real quick, missing the or having 47% or whatever it was on 43. set pieces, they only gave up 33 goals, so it's kind of like punishing them a little bit for they have, you know, they don't give up much, but when they have given up stuff, it has been on those. And look, if you want to play tight matches, which is what Nashville has done all season, and go through the playoffs that way, you have to be good on set pieces and penalties. Like that, otherwise, because you're going to end up in those positions. And the only thing I could criticize on the set pieces that would be to rethink is they use Walker Zimmerman as a free player. So they man up on each one. And this happened in the first round matchup against Orlando, where I believe Lovitz was matched up on the goalkeeper on DK. Yeah. And we saw how that one went, and I was like, oh, well, Walker Zimmerman would seem like a pretty good matchup, where you're like, who do we get to get DK? And you're like, well, we've got a guy right here, right? And I think part of it is because Walker is so good in the air, and you want to sort of give him that freedom to really go, to let him seek for it, right? And he's not going to be matched up on Gazdak in this one either, but I still think that, you know, if you're gonna switch that up, that might have been a different wrinkle to go with, where you're saying we're conceding a lot. Let's go with, you know, start with here, and we'll work our way down from the top with Walker. And then on the penalties, you know, I really think that first one, you're on the road, and this is where the goal difference came in as far as whether Nashville is playing at home or away. I think in those small margins where you're playing away at Philadelphia, and you're got the Sons of Ben behind you, and you have that home crowd and that energy. First, you imagine how Nashville and when they play at home and the energy that's around that team. I think those are small margins, and it changes where Hani steps up and he's your guy, right? He's your MVP. And the first one goes, and psychologically, Blake caught it. Like, Blake caught the ball, which is just to show you how good. I mean, I don't think it was necessarily a poorly taken penalty.
It was pretty poorly taken.
A little too close to the center.
Okay, well, he had a beat, you know.
He hit it hard.
Blake had a beat on it, and he caught it. And I think psychologically, that begins to wear on. Then Godoy saves that one, right? Puts it wide. So then the next two, you're stepping up, and you're like, man, this guy Blake is everywhere. Like, and he just took down two. And then you're like, I got to smash this thing into the upper, you know, upper corner to have a chance at this. And then you see it starting to wear, and next one gets skied, and the next one gets skied. And so I think psychologically, playing on the road and then Blake taking down that first one against Hani really shifted
so
the balance.
I get what Kalen's saying in terms of the set pieces and how you use Walker Zimmerman. And I think, though, because I was in Nashville on Tuesday, and obviously they give up a penalty kick goal, a corner kick goal on that one as well, and the conversation around it. And I think you see it in the reaction from Walker Zimmerman after the goal scored, because it's not the initial ball. Nashville doesn't really struggle with that initial ball, though it does head towards goal. It's everyone being mentally turned off to not react before Gazdag. Gazdag shoots, has it blocked, and then shoots again, and it doesn't feel like numbers are closing on him. The awareness of what's happening in your own box in a playoff game where you're leading 1-0 2 minutes before halftime doesn't seem to exist. And I think that's where you see the reaction from Walker Zimmerman. And that was kind of the conversations I was getting on Tuesday, was like, it's not really anything tactical. We just have to be locked in. Like, set pieces have to be big moments defensively where we are locked in, and we're not, and we don't know why. And that's
strange. That's with the profile of those players. Yeah, that's so weird. Strange. Because that's what they play throughout the match, completely locked in defensively, right? Like, so, and you go through and even think of their attacking players are all honest. You bring CJ Sapong back. He's strong. He's going to be, a weapon to be able to match up defensively. So it doesn't really fit the character of the team and the personalities of the team to tune out or not be ready for second balls, because that's how they get the ball, win it back, and then find Hani and CJ Sapong. So I don't know. It's confounding.
I was going to say, a lot more union talk to come. Do you want to put a sort of a bow on Nashville's season? Do we want to just kind of like wrap it up for them?
I mean, it was a great season. Like, this is for basically any expansion team second year other than LAFC and Atlanta, this is like one of the all-time great seasons. They won more games, collected more points. I think they're the first expansion team ever to win playoff games in two straight years. They went on the road to Philly and gave basically as good as they got for 120 minutes against a team that finished in the top four in the CCL. It's a great season. The one thing that they clearly got so right at the start of this was their roster build, collecting guys from within MLS. Dax, Godoy, Zimmerman, Romney, Willis, CJ, like all of these guys. Lovett's a huge one. You know, they did really well in the draft, picking Alistair Johnston as well. They got all of that so right that just going 1-for-3 on DPs elevated them from, hey, they made a nice surprise run in 2020 to, oh man, they're legit contenders in 2021. Now, if they can make sure that Ake Loba levels up next year from 21 into 22, something similar to what we saw with Hani Mukhtar. Obviously, I'm not saying Ake Loba needs to be an MVP candidate, but if he's the type of player who can be out there and be an asset in this type of game, then, and on top of that, maybe fix the set piece issue, then we're talking about a 60-point team. We're talking about a team that goes in to the playoffs, not necessarily as like one of the apex favorites, but certainly as a tier two team where it's like, yeah, if things go a little bit right, or if they get, if Joe Willis gets on a run in goal, they could win this damn thing. And that, like, we've heard expansion franchises talk about three-year plans in the past, and I always kind of snickered at that because the first 2 years were have bad players, and the third year was, oh, yes, now we've signed good players. It's like, no, this feels like what a real three-year plan is. They built such a great foundation, and it has served them so well through years one and two that they didn't have to crush it with their DPs. If they're able to get to the point now with Ake Loba, and then they'll probably have a third open DP slot. If they're able to get to the point where they have match winners, like real difference makers in those spots, they're going to be a problem for everyone in 2022. And the one thing that I think they have to worry about a little bit, though, is Dax McCarty's age. I think it would be wrong to ask
Godoy too.
Yeah, Godoy like too. You probably want to ask maybe 2,000 minutes each from those guys in the regular season. Try to find a young heir apparent, keep their legs fresh so that you can go into the playoffs on the front foot and with those guys playing some of their best soccer.
Look, Ake Loba didn't play in this game.
He didn't play against Orlando either. Two playoff games, they didn't sub him on.
That's got to be really demoralizing in some ways. Not just certainly for the player who comes in and hopes to make an impact and then is not even given that opportunity because of the lack of production or whatever else he's showing in training, but also for the club. They got to find a way to get the David Goss theorem rolling for next year, right? It's all about year two, but year one did not get the ROI. On that
also, brand new stadium.
Yeah, brand new stadium is here too.
Yeah, May 1st, right? And I think the Union are the first team to visit, aren't they?
Yes.
I'm pretty sure. I could be making that up, but I think May 1st, the Union come to visit. And that place is going to be beautiful. 30,000 fans. What a season for Nashville. You said it all, Doyle, in the way that they built it and the way they got so many decisions right. We'll see what they do next year to try to level up.
The Union.
Bam. My memory was right. By the way, we're going to talk more Union because this is a huge moment for them. Again, they might be hosting, depending on what happens on Tuesday. Again, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, FS1, Fox Deportes, New England Revolution, NYCFC. Let's sort of turn the page here and talk about the Revs. I think it's 23 games. I don't know. It's more than 3 weeks. Let's just start big picture for the Revs. By the way, Bruce Arena got the news this morning that he was the Siggy Schmidt Coach of the Year. His response to that was, quote, "I don't remember anyone getting Coach of the Year with a spit team." You can kind of like read between the lines there. Of course, Bruce shuttling the credit off to his players and staff here. But this is what they hired Bruce Arena for, right? Like, not just to rebuild, not just to sort of return them to more than respectability, but to the MLS elite, but to win MLS Cup. Like, that's what this is about. And they've got the supporter shield, and that's all well and good. But ultimately, this is the prize. And the window is there. I don't know how long it will stay open. There are some question marks here, and this is MLS, so we just don't know about that. Dave, what do you think about this sort of moment in time for the Rebs? What does this match mean? What would this run mean? Like, what's at stake for the club?
It felt like the league had left this franchise behind, and they're one of the founding teams, and then you talk about the 2000s and their success under Steve Nichol and obviously all the cup runs, and yeah, they don't win it, but you started every season talking about the Revs. They were must-watch TV. Dempsey comes through there. Like, all these things going on in New England. And then after 2014, they kind of fell by the wayside as a franchise. So I think Bruce Arena coming in was that last sort of gasp of, can we change this the way it is? And they've been able to. And I think a huge part of his success is the trust from ownership to him. Because it's not that they didn't have money to spend. It's not that they weren't willing to go and get DPs. I think it's just you have to know that the guy making the decision is right and it's worth it. And Gustavo Bow was signed, what, within weeks of him taking over? And Carlos Hill was obviously before by Brad Friedel. And then they go on this run. And this year has been unbelievable. You set the points record. They've done it in so many different ways. DPs, college draft picks, players like Andrew Farrell who have been around for almost a decade now on this team. They've used so many different pieces to put together, I think, one of the great top-to-bottom rosters that we've seen. And that's what's impressive about the points record is they've used so many different pieces from the bench. They've had injuries to their top players. They've had guys out for international, and they've still continued to roll on. I don't know that anyone will remember most of that if they don't make it to MLS Cup. And so you're in a situation. That's just the reality.
People remember that. They That's just the reality, the Doyle. Shield, right? We remember how LAFC was built.
Doyle,
2 years
if in
ago.
Three it, years it will, but someone breaks the record for the seventh time in 8 years, because that's what we're at right now, I don't know how much it'll be remembered. You're looking at an opportunity, two home games to make it to MLS Cup, to host MLS Cup. And one thing I can tell you from living in Boston for a time is when they're in big games and people know, that building fills up and gets loud. And so this is going to be, I think, an unbelievable atmosphere Tuesday night. If they host MLS Cup on a Saturday afternoon, December 11th, that's going to be wild. And so this is a once, I think, in a franchise opportunity to finally get over that last step.
I actually agree with Dave in a lot of ways, and I love this Revs team, and you know how I feel about Carlos Hill, but like for them, given their history, if they don't get there, that's ultimately what people will talk about when they talk about this team. They will say that was a really great team, a historically great team that did the same thing that every Revs team before it in that position has done, which is fall short. I think Bruce gets that. That's why you hire. That's why you hire Bruce.
Yeah, the window is now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean Tejon's gone. Buxa might Tejon's be gone. Gone.
Matt Turner.
Turner might be gone. TBD. We don't know. Like you don't know you're gonna get. Like Carlos Hill was gone for basically all of last year. He was hurt for a full month this year or more and couldn't play. You don't know that he's going to be MVP Carlos Hill forever.
That's why he deserved Comeback Player of the Year.
Oh, boy. Don't even get me started on that. Don't get me started on that. But look, I do think that there is sort of some selective memory in how good this Revs team is and how good this season has been as far as improvement goes, too. Like maybe it was the playoff run last year. I don't know. But people, I think, had sort of decided that the Revs were really good last year in this weird pandemic year. And this was just a continuation of what they had been. But that really isn't the case. Like, they wouldn't have made the playoffs this year if last year if it was a 17 playoff field. They were at 1.39 points per game. They were basically RSL last year.
Yeah, but they were missing
and then they got
Hill
back.
They were missing Carlos Hill for the entire year.
Okay.
And they were just like barely treading water, which is like
yet another thank you for making Carlos Hill's MVP case for me. Perfect.
And Comeback Player of the Year case.
Damn it.
Yeah,
to go from 1.39 to 2.15, like this isn't, I don't know. There's no guarantee they're going to be this good forever. They were sort of on thin margins this year anyway.
It is incredibly unlikely they will be this good next year, let alone forever. Like this is they caught lightning in a bottle. They have a great roster. They also caught lightning in a bottle with how well they played all season long, even the month when they were without Carlos Hill, even the month when they were out were without Matt Turner, even when Adam Buxa got hurt. Like they were able to keep it going, and it's a testament to the depth of this team, and I think the mentality and talent in that locker room. And you're right. Right, we if they fail here in the playoffs, we will think of them differently. But like that's kind of why it's great that we have an award for the regular season and an award for the playoffs. If you want to go down as one of the greatest teams in MLS history, win both. Win both. Like, I will say that LAFC in 2019 played the best soccer I've ever seen in this league.
I agree.
Best soccer I've ever seen in this league. But I'm not going to call them the greatest team in MLS history because they didn't win both. Toronto FC 2017 won everything they played for. That's the measuring stick for these Revs. And they're going to, like, they're coming off almost 4 weeks off without a game against a pretty good NYCFC team. It's going to be a tough test. If they're as good as we think they are, they will pass that test. They will find a way to win that game. They will get to the conference final. And, you know, they should be pretty confident against the Union, even though the Union's really, really good.
Got to get there, Kalen. What do you think about this layoff? Do you think it will slow them down at all? Do you think it will affect them? Do you think we'll see signs of that sort of lack of game sharpness? I don't know. I don't know if the Fire rolled up to Foxborough for a practice game or whatnot, or what they've been doing, but I'm sure they played Revs too. What do you think?
Well, we have to see the status of Buxa, right? Because he's on the mend and they're trying to get him back. So in some ways you say, oh man, if you're a Seattle fan listening, you're probably thinking, man, a little longer of a break might have been nice for us, right? To get that extra little bit where you get, you know, Rui Diaz, or in this case, you get Buxa back. So I think that will help them. I also just think the long layoff can be really tough. And I've done it before in playoffs where you play that Sunday, you play Wednesday, you play Decision Day Sunday, Wednesday is your first round, then you go to the weekend, then later in the playoffs you get a break for 2 weeks. And that was kind of nice, because then you're like all banged up from the playoffs and you need a couple weeks and you like kind of want to heal and get ready for MLS Cup or the conference final, whatever it is. But I think in this case it's really hard when other teams have been playing in the playoffs and get that kind of playoff sweat going. It's just a different feeling when you've walk into a match, if you're NYCFC, and you know, I've already been in that environment where if I miss this chance, or if I don't track this runner, if I let off for one little second, I'm out, I'm done. And I know what that's like, and I've survived it, and I've advanced, and I'm ready for this one. So I do think the first 30 minutes to 45 minutes, that first half for the Revs will be big. Colorado, they got knocked out, but I don't think it was because of the layoff. Yeah. They came out and had a very good first half. But they also played what feels like about a week ago and on Thanksgiving, right? And this is even longer. This is an even longer break. It's the last game of the round on Tuesday, I think, because of the Patriots' schedule or trying to manage that stadium. So Tuesday, it's a long, long time to have to wait. So I do think it could be something where I don't know how you replicate that. You can't really replicate those matches. And then even Decision Day was a game against Inter Miami, if you're looking back to their last, like,
I mean, they were in the parking lot ahead of the game. Like,
Inter Miami catching out a stray in the middle of a playoff.
Matt Turner's been at, like,
four
different.
That's not even that stray, dude.
Matt Turner's been in a Patriots jersey. He's been at a Red Sox game. Like, it's not to say they're distracted at all. I'm sure they're dialed in and training and doing all that. But it is difficult to replicate that feeling of being in the playoffs and having to wait for your chance to play. But they're huge favorites, and all the pressure is on them, too. I'm not sure it quite so much because NYCFC is a club that I think also carries a lot of pressure. But as far as winning the whole thing at this point, especially when you look at what's happened in the Western Conference, all the pressure to win this is on the Revs. And Philadelphia, they sold two best 11 players last year, are in the conference final for the first time. So they're playing a little bit with house money too, I think. I think this all falls heavily on the Revs, which historically has not gone well for them. But I think when you look at like this new team and Bruce Arena as a manager to be able to navigate those situations, I've seen in historic teams in other sports in the past, whether it's Cubs or Reds, whoever it is that can't quite get over that hump, Bruce Arena would be that guy, yeah, the perfect guy that you would want to say, come on, help us out. Like, how do we manage these, you know, a long layoff or any question, you know, he's going
to
have.
Apparently, I need to interject with a quick digression. Just, Kalen, you really have to start a lifestyle fitness brand called Playoff Sweat. Like, that's your $1 million idea right there. Let me know if you need a little bit of seed money, because I just bought a Powerball ticket, so I think it might have some.
Nice. Oh, good stuff. By the way, Revs hosting RSL and MLS Cup would, you know, that would be like a fitting into multiple fairy tales here, both for the Revs and for RSL, but we'll see if that happens. Three matchups for New England and New York City this year, all within the last couple months. In June, it was a 3-2 win in New York for New England. It was a 2-0 win in New York for New York City in August, and then in September, a 2-1 win at home for the Revs. What do you think about NYCFC's side of things here, Dave? Like, we sort of mentioned it here. Like, they've done basically everything in this league but succeed in the playoffs, in knockout round situations. They got the Golden Boot winner. They got a little bit of momentum. They got a reason to think they can do this.
Yeah, it's interesting because to all the points Kaylee made about that experience in playing playoffs, they weren't very good against Atlanta, at least the first 45 minutes, but in general, they weren't the team that we've seen. So maybe it's they kind of got that out of their system and they'll go back to who they were, being able to generate chances off the press, being able to use the ball to create opportunities. But they were able to at least get over that hump with Atlanta that they've always had. And we've talked about it a couple of times, but if Tati scores, they can beat anyone. And if he doesn't, it's going to be a really long day. So he scored the opener in the game against Atlanta, and that sort of gave them that ability to kind of push from there and go forward. All those games you mentioned were some of the toughest games the Revs played. That one in NYC or in New York, in the first matchup, Matt Turner was absurd in that game to keep the Revs alive. NYCFC pulled them wide, was able to find gaps between their space and create a ton of chances. And then the second game they played in New England, I think Carlos Heel and Gustavo Bow were out for that game. So it was a bit of a rotated team for the Revs. And that was the game I remember watching being like, okay, this Revs team is going to set the points record of like, this group is going to beat NYCFC. Like, this team is special. And so, but out of all of that, we've heard the confidence from NYCFC, the belief in their group, their fan base, their front office, that they are the team that can beat the Revs, that they match up best with them. And so it'll be interesting. I think there's a, you know, I think there's a good chance they come out and try and get a bulk of possession against the Revs and try and control the pace of the game throughout. And Maxi Morales looked as good in the second half as we've seen him in the postseason. And so he's starting to find his form, and James Sands settling in at center mid in place of Keaton Parks was really big in that Atlanta matchup as well. So I think there's a ton of positives there for NYCFC, but it all starts and ends with Tati. And that's why he has to beat the Golden, be the Golden Boot winner for them. And he has to be pretty much an MVP for them. He is the lone guy, I think, that can do it all in terms of chance creation and finishing.
Big questions, I think, for Ronnie Dyla, Doyle. And maybe not it's a question anymore, but just sort of a question on how to work out. You don't have Anton Tennerholm. You don't have Keaton Parks. You know, we maybe haven't talked up enough their quality and the absence and what that means for NYCFC. Tevan Gray did a great job at right back against Atlanta United, but this is a different attack in terms of cohesion, in terms of chance creation, in terms of the way that they play. I mean, what does NYCFC let's see when they look across the aisle?
So I thought Tevan Gray did a great job defensively, and he did a great job of getting into the right spots. Once he got into those spots, he did not execute. You could see him trying to hit the right pass, trying to hit those little slip passes to get Maxi Morales, who makes those diagonal runs out of central midfield, to get into the optimal assist zone for those Man City pullbacks. Every time Tevan Gray got into that spot to slip that pass through, he tried to, and I don't think he got the weight on it right even once. And that's the difference between a 19-year-old kid who's still learning the position. He was always more, I think, of a center back in GA and like the lower, you know, the youth ranks than he was a fullback. And Anton Tinnerholm, who's been one of the very best attacking right backs this league has ever seen. So they're trying to compensate with that. For a while, they were compensating with it by playing James Sands as a right back and having him do kind of an elbow back thing where he would push up only so high, then cut inside and, you know, become a more of a central midfielder. And they would leave that wing entirely to whoever happened to be out there. Sometimes it was Thiago Andrade, sometimes it was Tyus Magno. Obviously, you can't do that now because with Keaton Parks out for the playoffs, James Sands absolutely has to play as the six. He has to be it. So I think we'll see the exact same lineup that we saw from NYCFC last week against against Atlanta. I think that you just hope that Tavon Gray can execute a little bit better in the attacking third, and that somebody besides Tati can become goal dangerous from open play. There is an interesting aspect of this, though, in that last year in the playoffs, the Revs played a 4-4-2, which they're likely to do in this game, assuming Buksa can go. And Columbus was able to blow the Revs up, just completely dominate that game by flooding the midfield with numbers, just outnumbering the Revs in central midfield and controlling the game from there. And we've actually seen NYCFC do that to the Revs earlier this year. That game in I think it was June or July, where Turner stood on his head and won player of the week because he was so NYCFC completely controlled that game, and they did it by dominating central midfield. They don't have the same personnel, though. And that's the big thing. Like, if you're going into playoff games missing a couple of your best players, it becomes really, really tough. But there is a path for NYCFC. It's to press hard, it's to get on the ball, it's to make that 4-4-2 kind of fall apart and become janky and force the Revs to only attack with two guys and like quick outlets to Buksa and hope that, you know, the knockdown reaches Bo and they're able to conjure something 2v4. The Revs have been really good about not being forced into that, but the film is there. You could watch the film and you could see how teams have done it this time of the year in the past.
And that's the scary part, by the way, about the Revs is like NYCFC plays great against them and they won, right? Last year in the playoffs, they play at home, they win, they go on the road and they win. And that's why everything we talked about with playoff teams, cohesive unit, identity, culture, right there, the buzzer, it's time. but then also stars, Bo, Tejan, Buksa, capable of just creating something out of nothing. Like, NYCFC could dominate this game out the gate, and Tejan could go full field and create an opportunity, right? Or as Doyle said, a knockdown to Gustavo Bo, who just needs to be within 45 yards to get a goal-scoring opportunity. And that's the thing with this Revs team. It wouldn't be a RSL-level upset if NYCFC won this game. Mm-hmm. This is a really good team with a lot of really good pieces, but it would be surprising to watch the Revs fall at home.
Do we do predictions? I mean, all my bracket's completely busted. I think I do have the Revs going all the way. The Western Conference is just an absolute bloodbath. Anybody picking the away team? Anybody think NYCFC get it done?
No, I think New England will get it done. If I were NYCFC, though, I would come out and yeah. fly at them in the first in the beginning of the match. And then the big question too is, can Sands get in and around Carlos Hill? Because yes, if Tejan can hurt you and Bo and Buksa, but I think they can match up in a lot of those areas. I think the big part of what makes this team tick is Carlos Hill. And so if they can get around him, if James Sands can have like a big match tracking him, and we've seen him step up in big ways more as a center back actually with the national team, but I think by trade he's comfortable in the midfield. But I think it's going to be that kind of, he can play physical too. I know Heal is really hard to track, which is he can kind of drag you in and around places, but if they stop him and they come out aggressive, Tati Castellanos is a match winner. I think he really is. And I think when you look at those New England center backs, I think you're going to have trouble with him. He's different than a lot of other MLS strikers. So I think there's definitely a path forward for NYCFC. But right now, I think New England are huge favorites to win this whole thing.
I'm going Revs. I think they get it done. They just have too many pieces, too many players that can make that difference. The question is, can they keep the ball to the back of their own net? That hasn't been their strong point all year. Matt Turner, as you guys said in previous matchups with NYCFC, has helped that, but they haven't shut out NYCFC this year. There will be goals in this game. Revs need to score more goals. That sounds obvious, but that's the deal. You can watch the game Tuesday night. We got a pregame show on Twitter Spaces. Of course, we're postgame on MLS channels, and the game goes down 7:30 p.m. Eastern, FS1, Fox Deportes. Congrats again to Bruce Arena for the Siggy Schmidt Coach of the Year. He won Runaway. Robin Fraser, second, very deserved there, but Bruce with about 60% of the total vote, between 54 and 62 between all three categories of the player, club, and media. That is his fourth Coach of the Year honor. 97 was his first, 2009, 2011, both with the Galaxy, and now 2021 with the Rebs. So congratulations to
second
him. But
coach
as,
to win
I'm
it
sure
with
he would
clubs,
acknowledge.
Right?
Yeah, oh,
Bob
really?
Bradley's the other.
Yeah, Bob would be the other. Yep. Yep. All right. News and notes, random lesson, some mailbag real quick. Dennis DeClosa is leaving the LA Galaxy for Feyenoord. He is going to the Netherlands, and Jonathan Dos Santos will not be with the club. They just sent out a press release. The Galaxy did saying adios. Any thoughts on this change here? I mean, I think Dennis is a pretty significant loss for any team to lose an executive like that. And it felt like the writing was on the wall with Jonah that maybe this year was the end.
Yeah, they didn't get
Jonah. Jonah wasn't good this year.
Yeah, they didn't get production from him. I mean, he hasn't been healthy either. But it does show, I think, a turning of the page, right? This is Greg Vanney's team now. A lot of the players that were brought in this year felt like his types of players, and they're going younger. They're going in a different direction. I think all of it's positive. Dennis DeClosa is one of the smarter soccer people I've ever spoken to in my life, but it was a tough job for him in LA. Didn't feel like he ever had the full keys to the car and support, and it took so long to get off the bad contracts that he inherited that I don't think we ever really got to see the team he was going to build. It was just, can he find ways to get an Uriel Antuna on loan because he can't really afford to get anyone else? And so they kind of were always in this weird holding period, and the hope is that Greg Vanney can bring that club back, by the way. We talk about the Revs and Bruce, you know, the reemergence and all that stuff. Like, the Galaxy have been bad since Galen played against them, so that would be a good time. Not a knock on anyone associated, by the way. I wasn't knocking Galen, I'm just saying.
Oh, the days tick away, the years, the calendars change. But yes,
I'm not going to step up to defend the Galaxy. No worries
here. 412-0601 extra@mlssoccer.com. Any good mail in here, Dave, before we say goodbye? Of course, we'll be back Thursday to talk about what happens Tuesday and to look ahead to the weekend. Win MLS Cup, the matchup will
be decided. Jeremy Phillips, Portland has been the best and certainly are the best remaining team in the MLS Cup playoffs. Stellar defense over the last few months, buoyed by being absolutely unbeatable on set pieces, constantly goal dangerous, more wins than any other team. I mean, this is a no-brainer. Very convenient for them that the Revolution decided to enter some other playoff tournament that seemingly has nothing to do with the rest of MLS. This was, I think, came on Friday when Timbers fans were on a high and feeling pretty good, and I don't think you can blame them.
No, you can't blame them, but I think they have to have some question marks here without Blanco, with potentially without Espria. Like, they have the nice thing for the Timbers, I think, is that they have some attacking pieces that maybe aren't the shining light that have had to do it this year without Blanco being there. Dairon is a big part of that, but in Nijgoda, maybe in Valeri coming into the starting lineup, maybe they'll start Mora, I don't know. Yimi Chara has been really good. You talk about those, like, individual mistakes from RSL. Yimi Chara has exploited a lot of those mistakes. Seems like that's where he's at his very best. So I think they got to feel confident having it at home. But look, RSL's magic is there's something about that. Something about
and Rusnak coming back.
Yeah, Rusnak coming back too. There's a lot of wrinkles to that one. This is gonna be an interesting one. It's not the one that we expected. I certainly would have never predicted it, but I'm pretty excited for that.
I was gonna see if Weeby had a third Yimmy in him to see if we could get Doyle to break his computer. It's Jimmy. Jimmy.
It's Jimmy. Yeah. Sorry.
Jeremy Henshaw here says, "I love you guys, and you can all
it's
suck
Jeremy.
It."
It's Jeremy. Jeremy.
Yeah, it's Jeremy Henshaw.
Jeremy Henshaw.
I love you guys. You can all suck it from RSL fans everywhere. I appreciate that, Jeremy.
RSL fan, you didn't believe
Let's go,
either.
Baby.
You only
you
recently
can't tell
started
them anything
believing.
Right now.
Show us your bracket.
Exactly. Bring out that bracket. Bring out your perfect bracket. Not the like, not the first one you filled out. The burner bracket. Or the real one.
And David Spitz, who's, you know, big fan of the show and a legend, he says, rooting for New England all the way so I can go to the MLS Cup final. And I'm hoping if New England wears, there's some sort of multimedia amusement park style extra time booth somewhere in the stadium. If you guys are going to be there, are you going to go? The Thanksgiving pod was one of my favorite all time. Great coverage, great chemistry. Vamos New England for 2021.
Oh, you guys did a pod
DC
on Thanksgiving?
For 2022.
Yeah, man. Bro,
the grind.
That was a red wine
champagne for Charlie.
Champagne, of course, for Chuck. Champagne and turtlenecks for Charlie. Never anything below
Doyle,
that.
Doyle, we will stop doing pot. If they cut out our heart, we don't stop doing podcasts. If they
cut off
stomach,
my fingers.
Our fingers.
I think we should do it from Chuck's wine Ooh. Cellar if we do.
I agree with that. Or the Quinn.
Sounds like Charlie's hosting everyone for MLS Cup.
Yeah. we'll head on out to the estate or whatever, you know, like, I guess it's not pool season for Charlie, but I think we'll be good. All right, that's it for us. We will see you on Tuesday, I think, at least most of us, I think, Tuesday to do the post game after Revs NYCFC. You can catch that on MLS channels. And we'll be back Thursday to wrap it all up, preview the conference finals. We're almost there, folks. What, it's the 29th? Less than 2 weeks until MLS Cup on December 11th. So set your schedules, get ready. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on Thursday. We'll be right back.